Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own, and we take no directions from anyone else. We're thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 377 of Registry Matters. Larry, my old friend, how are you this evening?
Doing awesome. How are you?
I'm fabulous. So let's just get going and dive in and tell me what we're doing tonight.
Well, I think you missed something you were supposed to do.
Oh, I am supposed to ask you. Sorry. Yep, we are approaching your 190th birthday. That's in a couple weeks. And
how much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
Well, now that we know we can't get rid of you, what are we doing this episode?
Since we don't have any earth-shattering cases to discuss, we have a special guest. And we plan to do a deep dive into your second favorite subject after the Kabuki Machine.
Oh, sweet. So that has got to be plea bargains.
Yes, it is. We plan to examine the process with a person who has been on both sides of the equation. Our guest is Jerry, who is a former defense attorney and former prosecutor. Jerry has actually tried cases on both sides. In addition, we have a listener question that is actually within Jerry's expertise, since he's been a high school teacher as well as a college instructor. So he doesn't have to chime in on that, but he is certainly welcome to. And so that's what we're doing. The deep dive should take a considerable amount of time. And
all right. Well, then for starters, let's cover this. This came over my personal chat with a very longtime patron. And it says, I am a parent that is on the PFR registry, living in a state in the Northeast, and I'm being barred from my child's entire school campus. My state has no law prohibiting registrants from being present on school property. The only statute that applies to me restricts knowing and intentional contact with minors under the age of 14, and it bumps up to a higher tier if that contact happens on elementary or middle school grounds. Mere presence isn't covered. It requires knowing, intentional contact. Despite that, the school district has used this statute to ban me from the whole campus, elementary, middle, and high school buildings, all administrative offices, the athletic fields, everything. My daughter has an IEP, and there's a meeting scheduled for Monday, which is literally day after tomorrow Monday, not like some fictitious Monday, but day after tomorrow, that I want to attend. I'm planning to send the school a letter requesting either an accommodation or a renewed formal denial. The original denial is now stale, and I want a fresh adverse decision on record so I'd actually have something current to challenge if it comes to that. What I really need is an attorney to review my letter and sanity check my plan before I send it. The ACLU has indicated they generally only get involved where there's already an active case, so I'm wondering whether a national advocacy organization with in-house counsel might be a better fit. So my question is, when a school district stretches a narrow, knowing, and intentional contact statute into a blanket campus ban on a registered parent, what are my best options for pushing back? And does anyone know who could review a letter to the school on short notice before Monday's IEP meeting?
Well, first of all, for our vast audience, we need to explain what IEP means, because everyone is not a parent, and everyone, even they are a parent, they don't have any experience with that. So would you like to explain it, or would we like to get the educator to explain it?
I mean, I'll do it. Jerry, do you want to toss your hat in there?
Well, sure, real quick. An IEP is an individual education plan, and it is what's required under federal law for a student who's been described or who's been diagnosed as being special education.
Oh, your example is way better than mine. Perfect.
Okay, so what he's packed into this is a lot to unpack, and we don't know exactly what state he's talking about, but it's the Northeast, so we know that there appears to wind-driven snow, and they wouldn't do anything that's unconstitutional, so that's why they don't have any laws that restricts other than intentional contact with minors under 14. But then school districts are independently governed by boards of education as far as the public school system. And then you have the branches of public schools that are charter schools, and they have a different governing structure. And I even think our guest might know something about that. But the schools themselves, unless they're specifically prohibited from having restrictions about campus, they would only be restricted by the law. And on this short notice, I haven't had any time to do any research to figure out if he has rights to be participating in his child's IEP and the discussion of it, and the athletics and all the things that kids and their parents will like to do jointly. But I do know this, the conservative side of the aisle is very good about stressing how much they believe in family values and how much they believe that a child needs a daddy and a mommy, not a daddy and a daddy and a mommy and a mommy. And I'm just shocked that the conservatives don't push back more on stuff like this, because it goes contrary to what they say they believe in when it comes to having good familial support in education. But I don't know if there's any federal law that requires a school to involve the parents and guardians at what level. And I don't know if he could come at it with that suit. But if I were trying to dream up a scheme, what I would do is I would research and find out if there's anything that entitles him to presence in his daughter's education. And if so, I would threaten to sue under whatever that would be. So, Jerry, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I do, actually. So here's what would happen. First of all, consider the principal of a school kind of like the captain of a ship to some degree, right? They're part of their job is to manage the entire campus. This is an issue that it's apparently gone up to the school district level, so they've gotten involved with it as well. I don't find it very compelling that they banned this person from the administrative offices. However, it is a requirement under most states these days. The federal government has been pushing it that anybody who's going to have unobstructed access to a child needs to have a federal background check. Now, an athletic event, they don't. Make everybody have a background check who shows up to that. But if you want to volunteer at your child's school, you have to have a background check to make sure that you qualify to be there. If they are aware this person is on the registry, I can see where under the theory of protecting children, they have just simply made a blanket decision about him not being present on campus. But the real concern is whether or not whether he would have contact with the child. That's right, that's a crime that you deal with after the fact or whatnot. But the real concern is whether he would have unobstructed contact with a child or unsupervised contact with a child while he's on campus. And so in that regard, I think he has a couple of options. Actually, he has three options directly. One that might just be expedient. The expedient one is for him to be able to zoom in to the IEP. He can do that from off campus. That doesn't resolve the fact that they're keeping him out of the room, but it does allow him to participate in what's going on. So that could be an option. A second option is to arrange when he has to go on campus for legitimate business with his daughter, and a parent does have legitimate business with the daughter, for him to arrange to be escorted while he's on campus. We're not talking about a police escort or anything of that nature, but they could have somebody, an administrator, the school narc, somebody like that, who would just simply meet him in the parking lot and then go ahead and walk with him to wherever he is going, and then walk with him as he returns back to the car. And that would take care of the unsupervised access to children if he were to do that. And that may be something that they would be willing to do if it were suggested, but that's probably not something that they'd be willing to offer. The third is he could push for the IEP to be held off campus. There's no requirement to be held on campus. It's simply convenient for the educators to do it on campus. But they could meet off campus and do the IEP there as well. So those are three options, practical options about what could take place. But ultimately, if what he is doing is, I mean, what the district is doing is arguing for the safety of children, I don't see that as a case that where he's going to get very far unless they can show that they're being unreasonable. And that's where he needs to offer some of these practical solutions.
That's a pretty good answer. I would say that this is also illustrates how sometimes people overread the law. The fact that something is not prohibited by law doesn't mean anything. So he's read the law and he sees what the law does try to protect, which is criminality. But that doesn't mean that that's all the school administration can do is protect from criminality. They can be, you remember we always talk about prevention, how important it is to prevent crime. And it's better to prevent, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Well, if the school administrators have decided that they want to go beyond the law, as long as there's nothing prohibiting them from doing this, I think it's going to be a really difficult case. Now, in the state of New Mexico, which we're both familiar with, I don't know if schools would be covered, but we've got specific language in our Sex Offender Registration Act that nothing can be imposed by state and local authorities that's not in the Sex Offender Registration Act. I don't know if a school board, governing board, would be covered by that, but we've tried to stop the invention and imposition of requirements that are not in the statute.
I want to ask, just from experience with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, that when schools start overstepping their separation and trying to put 10 commandments in places, the FFRF will send an attorney signed, hey, you can't do this because of this, that, and the other thing, and they send that off, and often, not always, the school backs down because they have somebody that has Esquire after their name sending them letterhead. Is that something that might help him here? I don't think we have time to. But could Narsal send a letter like that?
Well, you would have to be presenting them with something that they're not allowed to do for that letter to be effective. If they're not prohibited from doing this, okay. So therefore, I think that letter would be very effective. Jerry, what do you think?
I think that you could make a case in terms of a parent's inherent ability to be involved in their child's education, and there might be something in the law in this particular state about the rights of parents with regard to school. A number of rights of parents bills have been passed in different states. But you would first have to attempt to find a middle way forward with them, such as saying, well, you know, how about you have somebody escort me? I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to work with you guys on this. And then they deny that. And then you ask that the IEP be held off campus, and they deny that. That's where then you can show that they're interfering with his ability to be involved with his child's education in a situation where he's been offering practical solutions other than unrestricted access to the campus.
Because, I mean, we're all familiar with using Zoom, Google Meet, whatever, especially during COVID. I attended several IEPs for my kid during COVID, and I was living four states away or whatever. So, I mean, like, that's totally an option of how it could be done. I don't know if they're just explicitly not offering it to be done.
Well, they probably wouldn't offer it because it's extra work and extra steps for them. Like Jerry's saying,
sure,
he's
sure.
Going to have to make that proposition to them. He's got to say, look, I'm not willing to stand aside of my child, aside from my child's education and improvement. Therefore, for me to be a participant, what about this option? Can we do this? But they're not going to bring that up.
I gotcha. I'm with you. Okay. Anything else? He is a patron, and I'm pretty sure he will listen. I will make sure that he knows that this was covered and that he can listen to it tomorrow after I produce it. So those are fairly tangible things that he could use to approach them with. Well, cool.
I agree.
Fantastic. So let's go, as Larry mentioned, we have a special guest today that is going to explain, because boy, Larry, I know I get it. Like, oh my God, those plea deals. I'm sure we've all heard this. If everyone stopped taking plea bargains, then that would make the system collapse and then everyone would get a fair deal, whatever the hell. All right. So what we're going to try to work through and explain is why plea bargains can serve the best interest of, quote unquote, the prosecution, the defendants, the victims, and the justice system. Now we have Jerry with us today. Jerry's been practicing law for approximately 30 years and has been a prosecutor and a defense attorney. Jerry's law practice no longer focuses on criminal law. Therefore, he has nothing to lose by being honest. Welcome, Jerry, and thanks for coming. And since, Jerry, you no longer practice criminal law, we will not be providing any contact information for you to drum up any business on our dime. So I will be asking you why you believe in plea bargains. But back to welcome and thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, appreciate you coming. So tell us about why plea bargains are a way to go.
Well, look, plea bargains are not perfect, right? But when they're handled properly, they can produce a timely, proportionate, and informed resolution while preserving judicial resources for the cases that need it. Personally, I like calling them negotiated pleas rather than plea bargains.
Many people hear the term plea bargain and think someone's getting, quote-unquote, a deal. Is that a fair way to term it?
No, that's really very misleading in a lot of different ways. Part of it is it's a negotiated resolution to a criminal case. You know, one of the things that I would advise my clients is, because everybody's different, some people, if there's a chance, just any chance, that they might be found not guilty, they will, it's worth it for them to roll the dice, no matter what the consequences are. For other people, having certainty as to what the result is going to be is their most important value. And what plea bargains provide is certainty, right? It's really a negotiated resolution of the criminal case. There's a process of negotiation, and the defendant's giving up certain important rights in order to do that, but what they're trading for those rights is being able to have certainty in terms of what the outcome of the case is going to be.
Then why would a plea bargain be good for the government? Notice the way that I pronounce that.
Certainly. So the government, what the government gets out of it is a resource savings, right? They don't have the resources to prosecute every single case and have every single case go to trial. There's not enough judges. There's not enough prosecutors. And frankly, there's not enough public defenders for every single case to go to trial. The other thing that the government gets out of it is they're able to protect their victims from having to be traumatized through the process of going to trial, and the level of trauma that a victim might have from going to trial oftentimes can lead to a better, shall we say, bargain, a better inducement to avoid that by coming to a plea deal and the defendant getting consideration for that. So, again, also for the government, that what they get out of it is certainty as well. Everybody gets certainty out of the process.
So the answer then, though, is all defendants should simply refuse to negotiate and the system would crash.
Yes, that is to some degree true, but that isn't going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen is because the defense attorney has an ethical obligation to work on behalf of his or her client. And so the problem that you have is, let's say everybody decides we're just not going to go to trial. Well, we're going to still be able to resolve about 20% of the cases and through the system. And those people, those defendants will probably get a much harder than what a negotiated agreement would be, and especially if everybody was refusing to go to trial, a plea, change their plea, and enter into negotiated agreement with the state. What people would do then, what the state would do is make a better offer. So basically, then as an attorney, you would be advising your client, well, if you don't go to trial, there's no jail time, but if you do go to trial, you might be looking at 12 years. Also, here's the other thing. The attorney doesn't get to decide if the case goes to trial or not. That's a decision only the defendant can make. It is the attorney's job, ethically, to get the best options available for the client, present those to the client. It's the client who makes the decision. Now, a lot of times attorneys will put the squeeze on a client because either they're not prepared to go to trial, or because they recognize the hazard that the client will be in if they don't accept the deal. But it's ultimately not the attorney who makes that decision. It's the defendant.
Well, then how do plea bargains help the victims?
Victims, as I was mentioning before, victims, you know, the process of having to go into a room and testify in a case where you are face-to-face with the person who, from whom you're a victim, right? While it's still in trial mode, we call those people alleged victims because we don't know yet if they're a victim until there's conviction. And those, right, so that's very traumatic to have to go through that whole process. It also delays the case quite a bit. And so the thing is, if the victims are saved that, right, it is, again, it provides certainty for the victims as well. Now, victims a lot of times are really angry when there's a plea because they feel like the person is getting off from the sentence that they might otherwise get. But a lot of victims, the worst thing that they will have to ever do in their life is get up and testify.
And then, of course, why are the plea bargains good for the defendants?
For the defendant, well, right, the defendants get certainty. They get certainty, and they should also be getting an inducement to give up certain rights. So what you're getting is, and part of this has to do with who the prosecutor is and who the judge is. When I was a prosecutor, I always made sure I was just a little bit more lenient than the judge that I was in front of. Because as long as I was more lenient than the judge, it's better to make a deal with me than have to face this particular judge on for sentencing. Because if the judge makes the decision, it's going to be worse. Candidly, not every prosecutor makes that calculus. Sometimes you're better off just rolling the dice and seeing what happens with the judge. But for the most part, like I said, you get certainty in the process.
Is it fair to say that plea bargains protect innocent defendants?
No, not really. But you know, it's really a complicated thing, right? Here's the thing. A trial, it's not really about guilt or innocence. We like to think it is. That's what we're all taught when we're in school. And that's, you know, what the movies all show, is that trials are about guilt or innocence. A trial is really about what can the state prove.
Yep.
And part of what can the state prove is based on how the law is written, right? What are the elements of the law? And so it doesn't have to do with whether anything happened or not. It has to do with what the evidence is. Frankly, a really well-fabricated lie can be a very powerful tool for a prosecutor, and sometimes the prosecutor is not even aware of it. So somebody could be innocent. And so the thing is, innocent people plead guilty all the time. And a lot of times, innocent people plead guilty because, again, they don't know what's going to happen if they go to trial. They don't know what the result's going to be. And what they're trying to do then is get that certainty so that in, you know, if they are given the opportunity of no jail time or no further jail time, that's worth a lot for a lot of people. And especially if they're being held in custody while the case is pending for trial. You know, somebody who's looking at a trial that is scheduled for 15 months down the line, then they're going to have to stay in jail that whole time. Or if they plead guilty to something at some level, they'll be let out. It's a very rational decision for an innocent person to plead guilty.
Interesting. I met many people that claimed innocence while I did my time, and everyone's innocent, right?
Right. No, absolutely. Right. And of course, you know, what you'll find out is there, everybody there has a really solid theory of the law, and you have to consider that they're all behind bars, right? Who have these theories. But you know, at the end of the day, go ahead. Yeah. I was going to say that it's when there's a plea, though, the judge won't just accept a plea if it's offered, or at least they're not supposed to. The judge is supposed to make sure that the plea is knowingly done, voluntarily done, and it is supported by a factual basis.
But you just were describing something that probably most are not really familiar with. You just were describing factual basis, and I've heard Larry use the term over the years. So what is a factual basis, and why is it so important?
Well, it's important because the defense attorney has a responsibility, an ethical obligation, to look out for the best interests of the client. The prosecutor has a dual responsibility, and they often forget their second responsibility, right? The first responsibility is to seek justice on behalf of the state. But the second responsibility actually that a prosecutor has is an ethical obligation to look out for everybody within the system. However, the judge's obligation is not to allow a defendant to waive their rights if the judge determines that there's really nothing behind this, or that the person is being forced into this, and that it's not knowing and voluntary, right? That they have to understand the process, they have to be doing this in a voluntary way, and that they have to believe that the state would have enough evidence to be able to convict somebody. And it happens incredibly rarely. But I have seen on one occasion in my 30 years, a judge refused to accept a plea because the judge was not a plea deal that was presented because the judge was not convinced that there was a proper factual basis behind it that could have resulted in the person being convicted of what they're pleading guilty to.
Can I ask you to go into any of the details? I'm not trying to get you to out anybody, but that just sounds kind of amazing that the judge says, no, I'm not accepting this because this doesn't seem like it's legit.
It was a really weak case that the state had, but the defendant was very, very nervous about being in the system. And the defendant was just needed to get it over with and was just fixated on whatever it is, whatever I got to do just to get this hell in my life over with so that I can start moving on to the next chapter, whatever that chapter is. And the judge picked up on that. And the judge picked up on the fact that the state's case was weak.
I thought you might say something like the person wrote some message in the sand with some seashells or something like that and was getting prosecuted.
Well, right. I mean, these things happen too, right? Yes.
Of course. So, but why not take every case to trial? Wouldn't that be more just to put the evidence before the peers and all that and make them do the decision?
Well, again, like you've got this ethical obligation, though, the rules of professional conduct for lawyers. I mean, a lawyer can be disbarred if they recommend things to the client that is not in that client's interest. And so the thing is, the more jammed the system is, the better the inducement becomes to from the state to get someone to plead guilty. And so if everybody stopped accepting plea bargains and said, we're going to take everything in trial, then the state would give even better and better inducements, better and better offers to people. And that would just be incredibly unethical for the lawyers to say, yeah, just roll the dice. It could go well for you, but it could go so badly for you, right? But again, the problem there is that it's also the defendant that makes that decision, right? But, and you know, look, I mean, would you have, if there had been an opportunity for you not to go behind bars, would you have taken it?
I did take it, and that's how where it ended up. It could have been a metric shit ton worse.
That's exactly it. And so what you got was the level of certainty. Yes.
Do plea bargains mean defendants are being pressured to give up their rights?
Oh, that can happen. That can absolutely happen. And it's one of the reasons why judges, I mean, yes, you know, right? It's one of the reasons why judges have to have to carefully question defendants before accepting a plea. And a lot of judges don't do that.
I wasn't.
But that's a right. Like you have personal experience with this, right? But you know, the court is supposed to be required to make sure the defendant understands the charges, the penalties, the rights being waived, and the terms of the agreement. But the reality is, for a lot of judges, they just see this as an expedient way of getting rid of a case on their docket. And they just move forward with it, and they don't want to disturb things because the result of disturbing, they don't know what, here's the thing, part of it is judges don't know what was behind the negotiations. They don't know what they're going to be disturbing if they reject a plea. And so, you know, but pressure, being under pressure and not having a choice are two different things. A lot of times people say, I didn't feel like I had a choice. But at the end of the day, a defendant facing criminal charges, they're under a lot of pressure. But the legal question is, was this a rational decision to accept this versus the greater consequences, intrinsic and extrinsic, that might have happened by going to trial?
And so then what role does the judge play in all that?
The judge is not supposed to be a rubber stamp, right? But the jurisdiction, depending on the jurisdiction, the type of plea agreement, the judge might have discretion to reject the plea or may not be bound by the sentencing recommendations. And this is the biggest thing, right? Is that in federal court, you can come to a sentencing recommendation with the federal prosecutor, but that's only a recommendation. It's not a sentencing agreement. In my state, state prosecutors are able to come to a sentencing agreement. There was one time when I was prosecutor, I was in court, and look, this was a low-level offense. We were talking a misdemeanor, and I was in front of a judge I'd never been in front of before, but she was known for being very hard on people. And the defense attorney told me, look, this judge knows my client and is going to screw my client to the wall. We need a sentencing agreement that will limit what the judge will do. And what they were willing to do in a sentencing agreement wasn't unreasonable. So I said, yes, let's do a sentencing agreement, even though I know this judge doesn't normally do it, but you're not asking for anything unreasonable. We get called up, we go up before the judge, and the judge reads the plea, and I see the judge look at the defendant, and I see the look in her eye as she looked at that defendant. I thought, oh, this judge is truly out to screw this person. And this was the charge, like I said, it was a low-level charge, right? Normally someone would be facing up to 7 days in jail, but the judge had jurisdiction to send them to jail for up to a year. So 52 times the normal sentence that you see. And the judge said, yeah, I'm willing to accept this. However, and then she scratched out the sentencing agreement. And she said, I just need you to initial right here because I'm not going to take the sentencing agreement. And I realized what was at stake. And also I realized it wasn't a terribly serious case. And so at that point, I said to the judge, Your Honor, the sentencing agreement is part of the plea. And so the judge said, fine, there's no plea today. We're going to go to trial, and we're going to go to trial right now.
Wow.
And frankly, the judge pissed me off, honestly, because I thought the judge was being inappropriate. And I looked at the judge and said, Your Honor, we're not going to go to trial in this case today. And she looks at me and she said, it's my courtroom. And I just cleared out the rest of the document, and we are going to do the trial today. And I finally, as the prosecutor, I finally looked at the judge. I said, Your Honor, you can't do a trial when there's no charges pending, and I'm dismissing all the charges.
Wow. Really?
Yes. Now, I will tell you, however, by the time I got back to my office, my supervisor had already received a call from the judge.
Yes, I imagine so.
This is not the kind of thing you can do every day. That's the kind of thing you can do once in your career, and only if it's a low-level case where it's not going to blow up. But yes, I mean, this is the thing, is you know, in theory, the theory behind the judicial process and plea bargaining is that the judge provides the appropriate judicial oversight because the plea has serious constitutional consequences. Unfortunately, a lot of judges just simply do a rubber stamp, but that is not their job. Their job is greater than that.
Well, so from your experience of being both on both sides of a prosecutor and a defense attorney, did you see plea bargains differently from each side?
Oh, I absolutely did. As a prosecutor, if I go to trial on a case, the victims feel good about it. Even if the trial goes badly, as long as I did a good job and as long as the victims feel like I did a good job, and I don't work for the victims as a prosecutor, but there's a lot of public pressure that comes with it. And so if I'm able to do a good job and even if we lose, I feel bad about that, but there's no tangible consequence in my life other than feeling bad that I might have let down the victims, even though I might have explained to them in advance how I saw the case, right, as a prosecutor. As a defense attorney, however, one of the things that I quickly realized was, wow, my client has a lot at stake. Sure, I still get to go home as a defense attorney, right? As one of my colleagues one day said, you know, if the case gets dismissed, I eat steak. If my client ends up being found guilty, I still eat steak. Sure, for the lawyer, that's true, right? That's totally true. But if you've got a lawyer who actually cares about the well-being of their clients, then you realize just how much is at stake, and you realize how you're able, through proper negotiation, you're able to create a path for your client to make a rational decision to avoid a lot of the worst consequences that may come. And a trial is something that just really, if you take your job seriously, it could just, it really creates a lot of stress, because the only thing standing between you, between this person standing next to you and 50 years in prison is whether or not you're, as the lawyer, you're able to have a good day in court that day.
So then what makes a plea bargain even fair after all of that?
Well, what makes a plea bargain fair, right, is that several features, right? The first is that, right, the defendant must understand the rights being waived. Second, the defendant must have competent legal advice. And third, the government must have credible evidence that supports the charge, right? But then at the end of the day, when you do a plea bargain, the outcome still should be proportionate to the conduct in the defendant's history. And victims, a lot of states have passed constitutional amendments or have passed statutes about victims' bills of rights because people felt like, oh my God, victims aren't being considered in all of this. But, you know, really, though, a victim is just another witness in the case, or a special witness, but they're just another witness in the case. But yes, those victims, and then the agreements are placed on the record. This is in public court, so everybody needs to understand the terms. If you're just looking for efficiency, that's not fairness. It matters, but fairness has to be the driving force.
Sure. Well, I've run out of questions, but I do reserve the right because there are people posting a handful of questions here and there. But so, Larry, do you have any questions to tack on to mine?
Yeah, I want to get back to not negotiating, because I think there's an ethical breach here, but I want to make sure I'm not imagining. So would an attorney who just flat out refused to negotiate with the prosecution and permitted the client to go to trial and receive a severe sentence with a far more favorable option was on the table because the prosecutor said, hey, I'll do this. And he says, I'm not even gonna mess with that. Your case sucks. And they get convicted. Would that be a violation of the rules of professional conduct not to relay that offer and to take it seriously on behalf of your client? Because I think it would be totally unethical.
So let's unpack that a little bit, Larry. First of all, yes, by definition, a lawyer is required, any offer that comes in is required to communicate the offer to the client. Now, a lawyer who tells the defense, I mean, a lawyer who tells the prosecution, don't even bother offering me anything. The question is that being driven by the lawyer's ego, or was the lawyer given that instruction by the client? There are times that there are clients who will say, no offer is good enough. Frankly, let's take a look at James Comey right now. I'm sure he's told his attorneys, no offer is good enough. We're going to trial on this case. Well, there, those lawyers representing James Comey are completely justified then in saying to the government, no, we're not going to engage in a discussion about plea bargaining. Having said that, though, if the government were to offer a plea, that lawyer is still obligated to communicate that to Mr. Comey, right?
When a judge rejects a plea agreement, I want to know, is the government still in control of the case, or is the court in control, or does it vary? Who controls the case?
So the government controls the case, the judge controls the process, right? So if the government were to reject a plea agreement, then most often the parties would go back and negotiate further to address the court's concern, right? But the ultimate power ultimately ends up with the prosecution, you know. As I said earlier, you know, gave that story that I could only do one time without losing my job, right? When I thought a judge was unreasonable, I just dismissed the charges. So, I mean, in that regard, like, that's huge amount of power that the prosecutor can have. Now, most prosecutors never think to have that level of authority, but you could do that.
So we've gone pretty well into that. So I'd like to dig into the section about the selection of judges and skip over the rest about the prosecutor's power, because they have enormous power. When you vote for these people, they tell you how short staffed they are, when they tell you how they need more resources, they hold all the cards.
So you're telling us that they're full of crap and they're lying.
They decide what to charge, who to charge, what charges to file. They're the only branch of the three, there's three stools, legged stool. They're the only ones that have complete control of their caseload. The judges have control of their caseload. The defense has no control over the caseload other than to plead people guilty.
You know, a lot of places, right, that you'll hear them tout that they have direct election of judges, and this is a great thing because it means the judge represents the people of the community. No, actually what it means is that the judge spends more time being concerned about their personal well-being when a difficult case comes up than whether or not justice is being done. There's no perfect system for picking judges. When they wrote the U.S. Constitution, they made a decision that Article III judges, the full district judges, U.S. district judges, where you had a lifetime appointment. And the idea behind that was that they wanted people to be focused on the law, not focused on whether or not they would lose their job based on how they ruled on the law. And I think that's good philosophy. The problem is you get a bad judge, then you can never get rid of them. Right? So, and that's where there is no perfect system.
Well, when I became a resident in Mexico decades ago, we elected the judges directly here. I think that was a little bit before your arrival. And now we have this hybrid system that we've alluded to, where it's a complex system where they are nominated and appointed, and then they have to run for one partisan election. I feel the hybrid system we have now is preferable, but you pointed out that once the judge is appointed, he or she will undergo an election cycle. You're familiar with elections. You've got some experience in elections. Is that dangerous to an accused if he or she has to face a judge shortly before an election?
Yeah, I mean, let me tell this story. Several years ago, I had a colleague ask me to cover a case in another county. There's a rural county of the state, and the client was under a certain level of jeopardy, depending upon how the case went. And so I go up there, and the case is set for jury trial. When I walk in, the veneer, which means all the people who have been called in because they might serve on the jury, they were all sitting around in this small courthouse in this rural area. And there was a guy getting all these folks coffee and donuts. I later on found out that was the judge who had just been appointed and was going to have to run for election, that was getting coffee and donuts for all these community members who had come in, right? And then while we're sitting there, and my client didn't live in that community either, and I'm not from that community, and while we're sitting there waiting, the door opens, and about half the people said, "Hey, Greg," and that was the police officer who's going to be testifying against the client. And a few minutes later, the door opened, and the other half of the people said, "Margie, how's it going?" And that was the prosecutor. Now, I sized up that situation. We were prepared to go to trial, but I sized up that situation, and I pulled my client, well, my colleague's client, into a room, and I said, "We got to find a way to negotiate our way out of this. Because if you go to trial, right, like half of these people are friends with the cop, the other half, these folks are friends with the prosecutor, and then we've got this judge here who's up for election. He's getting everybody donuts and coffee. You get found guilty, you're not from this community. The judge can nail you to the wall in sentencing, be a hero in the community, and he didn't upset a family in the community, right? Whereas sometimes a judge doesn't want to sentence somebody because they got kin around there who are influential, right? But in this case, we weren't from there. That's part of what happens when you have elected judges.
Fantastic. To respect your time as well, like, Jerry, thank you so much. It was very insightful. I super appreciate you coming on. And you are welcome back anytime you want a soapbox to stand on and tell us about all sides of the equation. It was really fantastic. You did awesome.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Yep, thank you. So, without anything else, Larry, we got two patrons. One of them did actually do a stimulus level type of Patreon, and then that is CC, and then somebody, he's not really a new, but he had payment problems, and he was living out of his car and all this stuff. So, Joey, welcome back. He was fussing at us for picking on him earlier, even though we weren't directly, that he lives in one of those conservative places and wonders why he gets treated like crap.
Well, he's going to cancel again after tonight's episode.
That's quite possibly true. And then, so, hey, everyone, head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and links everywhere. You can go email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Leave old-fashioned voicemail messages at 747-227-4477. And, of course, you should become a patron. And those that are listening tonight, and those are going to get the full interview that we covered tonight with Jerry. And those are the Patreon supporters, and that is at patreon.com/registrymatters. And last thing is fypeducation.org/shop, and you can find some fabulous Registry Matters merchandise, including my favorite, the Kabuki Machine. Anything else, Larry, before we head out?
That's Give you it. The last I'll word. See you in about, I'll see you in about a month.
In a month? Come on, man. You're not going to be like that, are you?
You got a conference you got to prepare for.
Yeah, I'll be here between now and then too. So, all right. Well, again, thank you everyone for coming, and I will talk to you soon. Have a good night, Larry, and have a good weekend. Take care.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.